Welcome to Generation Now, the show by and for millennials and Gen Z. I'm your host, Troy McDonald. I've been hosting shows in some way, shape, or form since I was 14 years old, and I really don't know if I've ever been more as excited for a program as I am today. My guest today is one of the preeminent thought leaders in America who for decades has helped us frame our world in profound ways. In an era when truth seems futile and as decision makers attempt to wash away Black pain and the pain of the vulnerable, he stands in the gap, arms open, arming young people with the tools to stand in the gap and fight for our futures. I'm honored to have him here today. So honored. Please welcome Dr. Greg Carr, Associate Professor of African Studies and the Chair of the Department of African American Studies at Howard University. Dr. Carr, thanks for being here.
Troy, my brother, it's a great pleasure to be here with you, brother. I'm just like you, shoulder to shoulder, trying to help the world get a little bit better one day at a time. So it's an honor. The honor's mine, brother.
First, I just want to ask how you are, because you are so busy spending so much time educating and arming other people. How has the last year and a half been for you personally?
Well, I appreciate you asking that, brother. It has been, as with you and with everyone, it's been a real challenge. I mean, we're not going back to the world as it was. And I'm afraid that those who will attempt to do that are going to be in for a rude awakening. I'm not quite sure what happens next in education, particularly for those of my age, you know, those in their 40s and 50s who I've been doing it now for about 30 years. But, you know, I don't know what that looks like. And anybody who says they know what it looks like either has never done classroom teaching or is completely spitballing or has some kind of financial interest, but nobody knows. Nobody knows. I can't imagine what it's been like for you all. You know, we've had a window into you and the community there in Kenosha and in Wisconsin. As you can imagine, you've been frontline news, front page news for so long now. And I wonder, I mean, how you all have been doing, how you've been doing, how the community has been doing with the eyes literally of the world on you in ways that if there weren't, haven't been for COVID-19, would have been a story, but it wouldn't have been a story. We've been on 24/7 news cycle loop, sitting in our homes watching you. I mean, I hope you all are holding up.
Yeah, that's a great point. I did a show the week of the shooting of Jacob Blake, and it was a live show. I took over the entire weekend. I did like 2 hours of content for that weekend. And one of the comments, and again, Facebook comments are a very small portion of the overall population, but the show was about allyship because this community is majority white. And so I said, here's what you can do to help. And people were commenting, we don't want to be allies. We want to hurt you. We don't want to be in partnership with you. And I was like, wow, for them, for that to be just the open language, we don't want to work towards this. We want to be in constant battle with you. I was stunned by that. And it did knock me for a loop.
My goodness. Now, I think as part of what we're facing right now, being in physical isolation, the anonymity has emboldened some of the things that are deepest in us, all the passions running the full range. And to hear that is disturbing, because that type of energy has a tendency to animate, or not animate, has a tendency to kind of catalyze that energy in others. So to take that kind of combative stance in a country that is increasingly non-white, that will never be in the future as white as it has been in the past. And when you start looking at birth rates in this country, that's getting ready to really take a quantum leap in terms of the shrinking of the white population, it is, as a matter of national identity, national policy, it's suicide in terms of politics and culture to take that position.
And it's interesting, because I wanted to touch on what we heard this week from Nikki Haley and Mitch McConnell and others who have been attacking the 1619 Project from Nicole Hannah-Jones, critical race theory, which is an attempt, maybe a last ditch attempt, to kind of rewrite this history. There was even a representative out of Texas who said the 3/5 compromise regarding slavery was in order to end slavery, which was not true. So as we're talking about this changing America, what do you make of these attempts to rewrite Black history and the history of the country and its painful history?
That's a very good question, brother, and a difficult one for me to grapple with. So a 1619 project for me is, I think you put it quite well, perhaps a last ditch attempt to rewrite the narrative of this American experiment, but it is not, for me, a centerpiece of human memory. Even saying, I don't make a qualitative distinction between 1619 and 1776, because, you know, 1619 marks the English invasion in terms of bringing Africans into this English settler colonial project. But you can go back almost a century before that, when the Spanish came on the shores of the Southeast in Florida, what is now South Carolina, and the Africans who they attempted to oppress, that they brought with them, fought back, escaped, and joined with the Native Americans. And those Europeans didn't come back for almost a century later to when you see the British settlement, the English settlement, 1607. And then, so, but to me, 1619, 1776, 1787 with the federal constitution, any of the dates, they all tie to settler colonialism. And I think that is really the fight that is going on at this point. I think the shift is perhaps because of the momentum of mass movements in this country, mass movements over the last half century, you've seen a bit of a concession from white institutions like the New York Times. This isn't the first Black people writing in the New York Times provocatively. You can go back to Hubert Henry Harrison in the 1920s writing in the New York Times. I mean, but it, there's a shift, because I think what's being realized is this country will not continue if white institutions do not open up some space for voices other than the ones that have been running these institutions to speak. And I think what you finally you see is a kind of an attempt by the Mitch McConnells of the world, the Lindsey Grahams, another South Carolinian. That's South Carolinians. That's a whole nother story for another day, right? but at any rate, this whole crowd, they're trying to defend something that was never real and that has always been deteriorating and that simply cannot be sustained. So I wish them the best. I do, because it's a dying way of life. And like the Confederacy after the Civil War, they lost on the battlefield, but they swore they were going to win the culture wars. And I think that's what they're fighting. And it's a losing battle, ultimately.
We touched on it a little bit earlier about Jacob Blake. Obviously, we're in Kenosha. I just wonder what your thoughts were when you first saw the video.
Frankly, as someone who was born and raised in the South, I thought business as usual. State violence against Black bodies began with the establishment of this formation we call the United States. So there was really nothing out of order in terms of what we have come to expect out of this social structure. That makes for a kind of tragic irony in the sense that, unlike Ahmaud Arbery, unlike Breonna Taylor, unlike George Floyd, unlike those who've lost their lives, Trayvon Martin, Sandra Bland, of course, say their names as we always do, Renisha McBride, Laquan McDonald, unlike any of them, Jacob Blake did not die. That is in itself, tragically impaired as he is, a kind of bizarre victory in a society where we expect Black death. I think that, unfortunately, that kind of ugly underbelly of sentiment that you detailed a moment ago that emerged on Facebook in response to your work, I dare say that there are those who may wish that he had died. So when people say, oh, it's a few bad apples, I don't get involved in the kind of language wars over, oh, it's police, a few. No, state violence is at the center of policing in this country. In the South, police departments were formed out of the slave patrols. In the North, particularly the urban North, they were formed out of the policing of the poor to keep them contained in places like the Lower East Side of New York or Boston, South End. In other words, I'm very clear about what this is. And then we're not going to have a debate over apples. It's not an apples debate because I'm the one that's going to get shot.
There was a lot of talk this cycle, as you've mentioned, you know, from my mom's era in the 50s and 60s, there were white allyship during that time. And there was a lot made of this. Oh, my goodness, this is so multicultural. Your thoughts on this? To me, this is not, it was not new. Obviously, it's a new generation, but there's been a history of this. Or am I totally wrong? Or no. Are the incentives different for white people who join these movements?
A fascinating question, brother. First of all, no, of course not. We both know you're not wrong. And anyone listening who knows anything about American history knows you're not wrong. There have always been in the Black freedom and liberation struggle, those who were invested in that struggle who were not Black. You had some Native Americans, Cherokee and others who enslaved people of African descent. And then you had others like the Seminoles and others who fought alongside Africans in their own liberation struggle against settler colonialism. So I guess if we use the word we're using now, allyship, that extends back to the first interaction, as I said, in South Carolina in the 16th century between Africans and Native Americans. In terms of white people, certainly we see white Black resistance, usually along class lines, as early as, we talk about the 1619 project, as early as that Virginia colony, where you have indentured white folk who are alongside Black folk trying to get out of that condition. And in fact, that is one of the reasons whiteness emerges as a legal status and identity, as a cultural status and identity, as property whites attempt to reach out and give these poor whites who are allying with these Blacks trying to resist this system something. In fact, my friend Gerald Horn, the historian, refers to it as battle pay. He says whiteness was battle pay that elite whites gave to poor whites in order to give them a status that would break that alliance with the Blacks. So no, this allyship goes all the way back to any oppressive formation where race was at the center.
There is still a lot of work to be done, and whiteness is still a very powerful drug for a lot of people.
It is. Wow, man. Sure, that's it's quite striking, isn't it? Voter participation, which has been on a steady decline with a couple of kind of forestallings and then moving back in the other direction, but majority white folk, as you say, particularly after the election, John Kennedy and then Lyndon Johnson, what we've seen during the last half century or so is not only a kind of cynicism toward political participation in terms of voting, but we've seen a retreat in terms of who votes to the most passionate kind of committed to their view members of the electorate. And when that comes to, when you put that intersection with whiteness, what you find is a lot of these white folk who are voting out of fear. And I don't think of the Republican Party or the Democratic Party either as being any more or less racist. What I think of them as political parties. And in order to win elections in this country, you've got to get the most votes. In order to get the most votes, you appeal to what we come to refer to as our bases. White nationalism ceased being the primary base of the Democratic Party and floated into the Republican Party. So now the Republican Party is, which was not the natural home of white nationalism, the Republican Party is now the home of white nationalism. And so when you combine that with voter suppression, there's been a long retreat since the 1965 Voting Rights Act to suppressing voters to win elections. When you combine that with voter suppression, when you combine that with the changed demographics of this country, with the rise of Latinx voting population, particularly the younger Latinx population as it reaches maturity, what you find is that the white nationalist sentiment in this country that is now firmly lodged in the GOP will probably result in the Democrats not getting a majority of white votes in any national election for the foreseeable future of this country.
There was a famous study during the heyday of American Idol in which more people voted for American Idol than the presidency during that time, which is just crazy. But I do want to want to push back a little bit. For one party, at least publicly presents themselves as diverse, especially for someone like me who's Black, young, gay, right? My issue and my livelihood is at stake, right? Yes. Literally.
Yes.
And so how do, because there's a lot of push that I hear from young people. It doesn't matter if I vote. I don't care. Mm-hmm. Nothing changes. But I look at it as you look at what some Republicans are doing with anti-trans laws, which yes. doesn't necessarily affect me, but my community, right?
Yes.
Stripping away voting rights for seniors. My mother is going to be 71 or is 71. She turned birthday was yesterday.
Happy birthday. Yes. Yes.
Yes. And so it's going to be harder for her. I have to help her through this process, especially in Wisconsin. There's a lot at stake for me personally within the Democratic Party versus the Republican Party.
Absolutely.
But yet both of these parties are problematic.
Absolutely. Oh, man. You know, Troy, you've just put your finger on a central dilemma when it comes to voting as political participation. My friend, the late Ron Walters, wrote a book near the end of his life called White Nationalism, Black Interests. And he talks about how white nationalism, and I don't, you know, people have, some people refer to it as white supremacy, some white privilege, have you want, but white nationalism exists in our political structure, not just in both parties, but it kind of suffuses the entire structure. So once we know that, then we have to engage in, it seems to me, and Ron Walters talks about this extensively, we have to engage in tactical engagement. And you're absolutely right. Right now, the core of white nationalist sentiment is in the Republican Party. Anyone who says there isn't just is either not a student of history or is gaslighting. It's not in the Democratic Party. However, because the Democratic Party is not free from a variant of white nationalism, we're faced with a dilemma. Think tactically. The kind of anti-human legislation that has now latched and affiliated itself with white nationalism, you have to win battles in a war. And right now, the Democratic Party is the apparatus through which you have the best chance to create some space to win battles. One of the things the Democratic Party has to grapple with is the Democratic Party has to understand that once you've turned these voters out, we saw it in Georgia, Black Lives Matter organizers, Movement for Black Lives, other folks, Until Freedom, you know, all these groups that descended upon Georgia who have real and legitimate and necessary critiques of the Democratic Party, set those things aside temporarily to knock on doors, to get young people arrested, to get them voted. And then once those two Democratic senators came into the federal legislature, it gave the Democrats a 51 majority with the vice president breaking the tie to be able to push legislation. Now, poised from that, the Democratic Party turns around and says, well, you know, Joe Manchin is not going to do it, Kyrsten Sinema. And then these young people are like, see, I told you. So what the Democratic Party now has to do is confront the fact that you cannot say you are on the side of the oppressed, on the side of the folks who have been attacked because of their race or their gender or their sexual preference. You can't say you are on the side of these people. And then when they put you in a position to do something about it, turn around and say, well, you know, we've got to compromise. That is a recipe for delivering the next vote to the most retrograde, conservative, anti-social voters in the country, because those same people, like when you come to them next time, okay, we just got to get a few. No, I'm not. No, because this confirmed what I thought I knew all along about you. You just wanted my vote. And I think that's the kind of thing we have to really be careful. So you put your finger on perhaps the central dilemma, because the clock is ticking.
Running over. But you're one of the most unapologetic individuals I've ever met. You say whatever you feel. And so I want you to briefly touch on like how that is in an era, you know, I think for us, when I was growing up, it was sit down, shut up. And then when we turn 18, we're supposed to be these creative, amazing human beings. Luckily, I wasn't told that, you know, I was always talking, which
yes, I mean,
makes sense. But like, so how did that, especially in our community, we're told to just sit, like sit down, wait our turn, like don't yeah. make a ruckus, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So how did you do that? And then I also wanted for you to touch on, you said it during the program today, the colonial settler project that is America. And you mm-hmm. said in previous interviews that this might not last. What do we fight for? Do we fight for it? Do we continue to protest? Are we fighting for the wrong things? And what will a future without this project look like?
Well, I say it won't last because it won't last. Human history shows us that no society lasts. We're not citizens of the Roman Empire. We're not in the Greece. We're not with the Egyptians. We're not citizens of Songhai or Mali, or the Shang Dynasty. We're not. The Incas, the Aztec, everything goes. This country's going to go. I think all the settler colonial projects have been remixed. We're not in the colonies anymore. You're not sitting there in Native American territory anymore in that sense. So saying that really to me isn't even a provocation. I mean, it's just a recognition that human societies come and go. White nationalism was always going to be the death of the settler project. The only question was when. And by that, I don't mean the death of human society. And I think one of the reasons why people say, well, it doesn't matter, is because our identities, human identities, are always local. You know, you care more about the people on your block, people in your community. And then, if you talk to people, say, are you an American? Are you from the South Side of Chicago? If you had to pick, I'm repping the South Side. In fact, this is my high school. In fact, this is my block. No, so Paul Robeson dealt with that in the 1940s when he recorded the song Ballad for Americans. He asked, what is America to me? He said, the house I live in, my neighbors, white and black. I mean, so that's the first thing. My sentiment and my approach to the world, I think, is probably a lot closer to yours. My parents walked me to the ballot box because one from Alabama, one from Tennessee, like your mother. There was a time when they were not guaranteed that. In fact, they were told, this not for you. So even as a child, I'm sure, like, you come to your mother, I accompany mine. We go in the voting booth. You know what I'm saying? So I do it because, and I speak the way I speak because, like you, like I suspect every one of your listeners, we observe as children. And, being a Southerner, coming up in the land of the lost cause, I know what white nationalism looks like. I know what it looks like when it's being condescending. I know what it looks like when a black person is humiliated. I know what it looks like when an elder black woman or man is called by their first name, somebody who you call Mr. or Miss when they're in church. And I carry all of that every day. It informed my choice to go to historically black college, Tennessee State. It informed my choice to go to law school. I was going to be a civil rights lawyer at Ohio State. And then I got into black studies after I graduated. And I said, I'm going to teach. It informed my decision to work in public schools as an administrator in Philadelphia. And it informed my decision for the last 21 years to be a Howard. I made deliberate choices to be in black spaces because I'm against white people or any group of humans, but because I never wanted to draw a breath on this earth where I was trying to explain or apologize or somehow defend being human to people who question my humanity. So I really don't know how not to be human. And anyone who is offended, I take that offense as them trying to protect something that would create a hierarchy to make them better than any of us. Because I take human beings as human beings. Anyone who doesn't, they have the problem. And so I don't believe in trying to convince others of my humanity. And when people say, well, what about Martin Luther King? And what about the civil rights movement? And what about not being judged by the content, by the color of your skin? My answer is very simple. The people that rose up in this country and broke the back of white nationalism during the civil rights movement, almost all of them came out of black institutions. Martin Luther King wanted to integrate society, but his pulpit was not integrated. The schools he went to, Booker T. Washington High School, Morehouse College, were not integrated. In other words, don't ever overlook the fact that the people who made this country change its apartheid laws came from segregated institutions. They did not want to lose their cultural identity. They simply wanted the laws to change. Nobody is begging to be white. And if they are, we need to probably help them with some therapy or understand. But no. I think that's I will say this, though, because I often do say that about this country. What comes next is very simple. What comes next is a better society. And by that, I mean, what comes next is a society where we can just be human and reach our human potential, whether that's America, whether that's Wisconsin or California, whether that is different formations that come together and knit something else together. But I think what is not going to continue is that a couple of elected officials from one region of this country hold the entire country hostage and we just continue to go along with it. This country will fracture if that type of sentiment. Mitch McConnell is from Kentucky. The folk from California, the folk in Wisconsin who agree with our common humanity, not just going to keep putting up with one person holding something hostage. I don't mean secession from the Union. I don't mean a civil war, hot civil war, but I do mean local ordinances, local policies, local legislation passed that simply says in this city, in this county, human beings are protected. And when McConnell says or someone else says, you can't do that. No, yes, we can. And if you press too hard on this, the federal polity will fracture. And at that point, you have a real problem because there's a lot of people in Kentucky who don't like what you're doing. So, I mean, they're going to press this until it bursts, I'm afraid.
But I want to ask you this next question that I've been personally grappling with, which is that especially after January 6th, but last year, there was a lot of talk about the looting and the violence that was happening. And for me, I'm sitting and going, okay, when I was in elementary school, one of the first incidents of looting that I heard about was the Boston Tea Party and how these people were heroes for lighting boats on fire, tossing tea into the harbor. And that is heroic, but that is looting. But that wasn't framed in that way. This country has been violent. And so I don't know how to grapple with that. I'm curious what you've thought about that.
Well, let me answer that very quickly, Troy, in this way. What you said is absolutely accurate. This country was born out of violence. Settler colonialism is the definition of violence in the Western Hemisphere. The response to violence is violence. It's physical violence. So when the English, the French, when the Spanish are literally eliminating human beings who were here before, the idea that those human beings fighting back are somehow engaged in some untoward activity is absurd on its face. You're literally trying to kill me. Watching the trial in next door Minnesota, in Minneapolis, watching the elder break down on the stand crying, watching this mixed martial arts brother saying he didn't have to do that, watching these off-duty EMTs who were not Black, you know, some of them Latinx, others white, saying, I told them no, standing there, and then watching that little girl apologize to George Floyd for not doing more. Well, Derek Chauvin could have been killed on that corner because there were enough people to rush over there and break his neck. That would have been extremely satisfying to me, to many people who would have seen it afterward. And the fact that they did not do that, as Malcolm X might say, you should be happy that these people did not kill those policemen on the corner there. Why didn't they? Because there is still a nominal gloss of respect for either the rule of law or a fear for what the law represents in this country, which is violence. If you don't want people to be violent in self-defense, then stop being violent in how you treat people. It's very simple. It's as simple as that.
Wow. Well, this has been just the honor, really, of my lifetime to have you on this show and to hear your just incredible genius on display for me and our community. I think will be life-changing and life-saving. So thank you so much.
Brother Troy, listen, man, not only thank you for this conversation, I'm looking forward to the next one. And everyone listening, listen, it's a gift. It really is a gift for you to have a man like Troy McDonald with you. So to everybody in Wisconsin, everybody in the neighboring states, everybody under the sound of our voices right now, I want to thank you on behalf of all of us, because you're in that tradition of courageous journalism that has often made the difference in this country. So for those in your craft and for you personally, brother, I want to say the honor is mine to be in conversation with you.
Wow. Wow. Dr. Carr is the Associate Professor of African Studies and Chair of the Department of African American Studies at Howard University. Until next time, bye, everybody.